Yeah, so as Sanjeev said, I'm a semanticist who is somewhat computational. I don't know if I'm quite yet a computational semanticist. So I'm a linguist by training, at least with my PhDs in linguistics. So you'll be getting a slightly different view of issues of meaning today than we've had for the last couple of weeks, which is probably okay. So I'm going to talk about an issue that I think connects all the semantics groups that have been going on here to some degree. I won't be so directly addressing the first part of prelim, but one of the basic questions I want to try to ask in this talk is, what kinds of things do we need in our semantic meta-language? And I'm going to focus on attitude verbs, if this still works. Oh, there we go. So indirect reports, broadly speaking, involve verbs that embed clauses. So verbs like think, dream, ask, wonder, say, tell, discover, etc. There are quite a few of these. I'll maybe tell you how many later. So you get sentences like, Alfonso thinks that Joanne is a spy, Alfonso told me that Joanne is a spy, etc. So I want to try to get at, via progressively finer and finer grained issues, what is the right linguistic and semantic theory of indirect reports, clause embedding predicates, and embedded clauses. So I'm going to do this in two parts. So first I'm going to do a sort of sketch or tutorial about this problem from the linguistic perspective. So this has been one of my obsessions for my career. And so then this is going to be relatively short, completely informal, et cetera. I'm going to do a focus case study centered around the English preposition about, and we're going to see that from trying to figure out what this preposition does in interaction with attitude verbs, we can learn quite a bit about attitude verbs and get back to these big questions of what kinds of things need to be in a semantic meta-language. So start with this sketch or tutorial. So first I'm just going to try to tell you the kinds of things that as a linguistic, when I'm thinking as a linguistic semanticist, I try to deal with when addressing these problems. So first, perhaps the biggest issue is driving predictions about human judgments about truth and falsity in context. And the judgments I'm going to be talking about in this talk, for the most part, are easy. And by that, I mean they can be accessed introspectively by native speakers. So for example, we have this term that, as far as I know, has been coined in this workshop, language expert. I arrived after it was coined, so I wasn't sure exactly what it meant, so I was wondering whether I was a language expert, right? So this is true. This is a true statement. So I can tell you this in part this time because I have access to my own mental state. I know what I was thinking about. But some of you who had conversations with me when I first showed up, you might infer this from the things I said. On the other hand, I do not wonder whether I'm a linguist, right? So I am a linguist. I know the answer to that, right? So these are the kinds of truth and falsity judgments that we want to predict at the end of the day from the theory. I'm also quite interested in inferences, and the kinds of semantic theories that we deal with in linguistics are tailored to predict at least broad classes of inferences. Right? So for example, if I was wondering whether I was a language expert, you can infer from this that I didn't know whether I was a language expert. Right? So these are sentence-to-sentence inferences, et cetera. And then there's many of these that you can write down, obviously. So if Kyle is a language expert, he didn't know that he's a language expert. So this doesn't commit one way or the other, but notice the shift from know whether to know that, et cetera. And in general, I'm also interested in things like felicity and appropriateness in context. I won't be talking about that today, although that's been a big issue with the binary SRL group that you heard a little bit about and we'll hear more about next week. Okay, so that's sort of what we want in general from a theory of indirect reports with some examples. What about clause embedding predicates? So these verbs like think that take clauses. So this is what I'm going to be really focused on in the contentful part of today's talk. So what does their lexical representation look like? How do they interact compositionally in their syntactic context? So how does think combine with that clause, et cetera? To produce this kind, the classes of behavior of indirect reports that I was describing on the previous slide. And then closely related but slightly distinct, we want to know what's going on with embedded clauses in general. So what is their semantics? What is their behavior? What's the contribution of complementizers and markers? Like complementizers, I include about in this class, as you'll see. And then there's this huge, huge, extremely important question that I'm not going to get at today, although this has probably been my single obsession in my linguistic semantics career. So what's the relationship between root and embedded clauses and clause types? So the relationship between root questions and embedded questions. So
you just said the three or four things. You're saying that a good theory of indirect reports will answer all these questions.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. All of them have been worked on. We're not really close to having true answers to any of them, but that's usually the state of things. That's right. Going back to a sentence like Alfonso thinks that Joanne is a spy, there's this sort of prime candidate for an analysis in linguistics. This is often, if any of you have taken a semantics 2 class, usually you probably have learned some version of this. I teach it myself sometimes. So we have a verb like think, it's a verb. It has some syntactic selectional frame. I'll be using DP here instead of perhaps what's more familiar to you, NP. So you can just substitute NP for DP if you prefer. That stands for determiner. The prevailing view, incidentally, is that determiners are the head of the nominal phrase. This DP characterizes a holder of some attitude. So this is just a name for the role that I've chosen. It's reasonably standard. There's a clausal argument, say a that clause, that describes the content of the attitude. Some formatting issues. In a more formal meta language, which this is, I think, almost the last time you'll see this on these slides, I just aggressively cut all my lambda calculus and modal logic. We can formalize this using tools from lambda calculus and modal logic. What this formula says, paraphrasing, is that in all of the worlds, possible worlds or situations compatible with Alfonso's beliefs, the proposition that Joanna is a spy is true. So we quantify over ways that Alfonso could construe what the world is like and constrain them relative to his belief state. So on this view, you can't quite read it because I didn't check the formatting.
Maybe things is indicating that there are some possible belief mm-hmm. in which there just isn't evidence that she's not a spy.
So that's not usually what people believe. That might be true about thinks in some cases. So Alfonso believes that Joanna is a spy, certainly has this kind of force. Yeah. And then think is usually analyzed in the same way. I think that's wrong. We'll see some reason to believe that. So on this view, what you can't read quite is that the function of one of these clause embedding verbs is to relate an individual in a proposition or some other abstract object. And the relation describes this content thing. So here's a puzzle. Most verbs, it turns out, take multiple types of clausal arguments, multiple types of arguments that somehow relate to the intuition that there's this content that's being described. So we get verbs like tell that take that clauses, but also whether clauses, infinitival clauses, and of course about phrases, which I'll get to. So I wanted to quantify this problem. So I have a sample of verbs that I'll be working with. You'll hear more about that in a few minutes. So it's 554 attitude verbs annotated for various things, in particular annotated for selectional frames, among other things. Out of this sample of verbs that take clauses, only 8 take just that clauses, right? So in other terms, verbs like tell are the normal state of affairs. Attitude verbs are massively overloaded for the clause type that they take. The immediate puzzle is how this kind of relational count, however you want to think about it, if you're trying to figure out what the content role involves, et cetera, how can this relational account generalize across frames? And it's tricky, right? So the semantic roles alone are too coarse. even though I think the intuition is that they should work. So if you look at a verb like know that at least takes that and whether clauses, then you might try to unify these readings by just taking the union in the syntax. There should probably be an or there or something. And say that both of these fill the content role. And this, as an annotation strategy, is reasonably common as far as I've been able to find out. So VerbNet calls these things at least sometimes topic. FrameNet uses the term content. In the tectogrammatical layer, these are dependent content clauses that sometimes, I didn't find the definitive answer on this, but receive a thematic role that is a little more general than this, but they're annotated in a somewhat similar way. Yeah. What did you say? So in many of my claims, there's like a small residue of counterexamples, and I cut all these because only linguists usually care about them, so I'm glad you asked. I probably cut the slide. So the two clearest ones are things like rejoin and theorize. So you can theorize that it might be raining. You can't theorize whether it's raining, et cetera. So they're not really high frequency verbs even. They're a little unusual. So just to illustrate why thematic roles alone are too coarse. So you can find pairs that where we minimally change the complementizer to vary between a question and a declarative. So Kyle knows whether he's a speech expert. That's true. I'm not, at least by the way that phrase has been being used at this workshop. Kyle knows that he's a speech expert. False, right? Because I'm not. Okay. It probably is true in some sense that both of these clauses are describing the content of the attitude. Something else has to be said about exactly how, and this is where clause type will come in general. So you can go the other way, and this is probably the standard approach in at least textbook presentations of these accounts in semantics. Suppose that we just have a separate lexical entry for all of these verbs with different syntactic frames. So we have a different entry for know that and know whether. And the finer grain differences are cached out in modal logic that I'm not really giving you. These are some paraphrases. So know that involves the holder's belief state entailing the proposition. Know whether involves that for every possible answer to the question, whether phi, the holder's belief state entails that answer if it's true. So this can be done. The details aren't especially important right now. Of course, this seems to go too far because this apparently accidental polysemy seems to mask generalizations or explanations, right? So at least thinking as a linguist, I want to know why there seems to be some common core between these two lexical entries. At the local level, the intuition is just that know that and know whether are related somehow, right? At the global level, we can go back to this quantitative thing I did. There's just very few verbs that really only take one type of these. So is that an accident? It seems unlikely. And finally, there's some very interesting recent work coming out of Maryland showing that selectional patterns, so syntactic selectional patterns, seem to cluster together with semantic selectional patterns. So the generalizations that you find in selectional patterns aren't accidental, right? So we need something a bit more explanatory to say how verbs relate to content arguments. So here's what I'm going to do now. So this ends the very general presentation of the kinds of questions that I ask when thinking about these issues as a linguist. Now I'm going to go into this focused case study on about, and hopefully going to learn some exciting things. Many of the verbs that you've seen already take about phrases. You can ask about Mary, you can ask about whether Mary dances, you can wonder about Mary, know about Mary, think about Mary, etc. Just to give you an example of one kind of case to prime your intuitions a little bit. Suppose that the scenario is that Mary was recently arrested and this is reasonably common knowledge between some speakers. In this kind of scenario, you could say something like, Alfonso knows that Mary was arrested. You could also use Alfonso knows about Mary as a kind of shorthand in this context for the claim in A. And so this suggests that at some level, the approaches that, well, I haven't actually talked about what roles people try to assign to about phrases, but it does seem to have something to do with content again. Not obviously quite the same, but related. So about Mary tells us something about the content of the knowledge. It doesn't seem to exactly tell us what this is. In context, you are able to infer what it is. There's a bunch of other cases where about occurs that are, in this talk, sort of a side issue, although they're pretty important for the overall story. You get about with a rich set of nouns as well, and you get it showing up as a predicate in copular sentences. But if you're interested, we can come back to that, but I'll just move on. So here's where I hope to get to in the rest of this talk. So I'm going to show that about phrases are modifiers, not arguments, even though they look like they're arguments that have something to do with this content role. They do not receive a semantic role called content or other ones along those lines, although they do something quite similar to what something getting a content role would like. They instead characterize the content, lowercase c, of an event via event modification. Okay. And this leads to a reevaluation of the textbook approach that I presented at the beginning. These predicates aren't, their function isn't to relate holders and propositions. Their function is to characterize an event, and that event has some content that relates the holders and propositions. And so for those of you outside semantics, I can never tell. This might seem like a very subtle distinction. This is really a major rethinking about what an attitude is, I think, inside semantics and philosophy of language. So it's important, at least to us. Okay. So now I'm going to turn to some hypotheses about. So what could an about phrase be doing in these examples that you've seen? So here's what syntacticians, linguistic syntacticians, tend to come up with when you present them with this data. First is a kind of null hypothesis. If you have a sentence like Alfonso thought about his cat, there's a DP or NP, whichever you prefer, in there. And perhaps about is functioning just to what's termed in syntax case license, this nominal phrase. So it's there primarily for a formal or syntactic function and doesn't necessarily have any meaning itself. And so on this view, these things might would presumably map to various thematic roles, whatever the verb can assign. So the preposition would be idiosyncratic, basically. There's actually, so this has been proposed in the early 80s by Pazetsky. There is a large class of idiosyncratic prepositions that seem to serve a similar function. Dealing with these is even harder than dealing with about. And this is also consistent with an early philosophical view that natural language about is just too messy for a single unified analysis. They just threw up their hands and said, these aren't the same about, right? There's just different abouts going on. Well, Pazetsky recanted this view because he noticed that in cases where you can get, say, both a nominal phrase and an about phrase, there are meaning differences. So John asked the time does not mean quite the same thing as John asked about the time, right? So this can be true in a broader set of circumstances. Here's some other examples I've generated that might be a little clearer. John found out the price of milk means he found out the value of that price. John found out about the price of milk could mean that, but it could also mean he found out that it had changed or fallen or et cetera. So there's the readings for the about phrases are a bit freer. So this case account would really predict the same meanings between all of these pairs above. We could ask this with other prepositions. I'm going to skip that. So the preliminary conclusion is that about is not just a case marker. This is probably fine with many of you. I don't know that this appeals to anyone except syntacticians. And the point is that it does seem to trigger fine-grained meaning differences not captured by the content role or by any particular role. And we have to actually ask, what's the semantic contribution of about? Okay. Second hypothesis. So we think about has a meaning now. Perhaps we can reduce its meaning to some known argument slot. And what I mean by that is, so you have pairs like John told me about who had the winning number, first John told me that Mary had the winning number. And so this proposal, first put forward by Bohr, is that we can coerce about phrases into propositions. And he had a story about how to do this sort of pair, although it doesn't generalize. So basically, this means deriving a that clause meaning for, or interrogative clause meaning, depending on how you go about it, for about phrases. I think you can think of this as coercing about phrases into some kind of normalized representation to allow them to just be plugged in to the content role, if you are willing to believe in a content role. So that's view two, plausible. Wrong, but we'll see that later. View three is that they're modifiers. I already foreshadowed that this is what I'm gonna argue for. And so for those of you who are into event semantics, this fits into the broad class of modification phenomena first looked at in philosophy by Davidson. So Davidson already observed that to try to deal with slowly in sentences like 24 involves rethinking the nature of verbs. So this would push us towards an event semantics for attitude verbs. One more possibility. We linguists like hypotheses. This is distinct but somewhat similar to the things that I've already shown you. So the possibility is that about phrases fill an argument slot distinct from the content role. Okay, this is, I believe, effectively what FrameNet has decided to do. So FrameNet instantiates this analysis. They have a topic role for about phrases and a content role and subroles of that for clausal arguments. There's some terminological clashes. This isn't quite the same thing as VerbNet topic, which includes both classes. So VerbNet instantiates the earlier approach, or that's the closest one. Then this leads to the question of what's the relationship between topic and content, right? So these roles capture that there's this difference. They don't seem to make predictions about any particular differences or whatever similarities there might be. And we've already seen that there's similarities. So topic and content are not independent. Okay, this is a different version of the Joanna being arrested example. Right, so basically, from topic, you can infer content, if this is the right way to go. And then, as a linguist interested in inferences, I need to provide a theory of how that inference happens. Okay. There's one particular version of this that I think in this audience I should skip. It connects to this long and complicated thread of investigation into day-rate belief and race arguments in the philosophy of language literature. If you're interested, you can ask me. I'm going to move forward to more interesting things. So now we want to decide between these hypotheses. And so I'm going to present, I think, four arguments that really conclusively push us towards the modifier account. And then we have to figure out what to do about that. So fact one, or argument one. So about phrases are always optional in contexts where they can occur. Okay. So this is something that, as a linguist, is, when you first look at it, a little hard to assess. As computational people working with large data sets, it's pretty straightforward to think of how to do this. We need some kind of reasonably large data set, and this is what I've developed to try to test claims like this. What I did is I tried to get as big of a list of content verbs as I could. This includes currently around 550 unique verbs, some different senses that I absolutely had to distinguish. And most of this was derived from corpora, COCA mainly, if you're interested. And then I coded for selectional properties. I did this all myself. There's obviously many interesting things that one could do with extracting this kind of data. This was work that I really did. This coding part was something I did about 2 years ago, so now I think I would approach it differently. So I'm still working on that. I'd be happy to talk to any of you about getting this data. I already talked to Martha, and she had just immediately had some ideas. So, Okay, so I'll be using this data set to test various claims. So in particular, I coded for whether verbs can combine with about, can or may combine with about. There is exactly one verb of these 550 that this, under this way of looking at things, which is a little surfacey, requires about. This is the verb bandy, which, and bandy about is clearly an idiom chunk. It probably derives from a different sense of about, even. It means to toss about an idea, for those of you who aren't native speakers. So this claim seems pretty strong. There are other things lurking in my data set, like the way I coded things wouldn't distinguish the fact that see about probably is an idiom chunk with a distinct meaning from see. But I do think that those cases are pretty minor. So this is a clean and strong generalization about whether about is required. And this is surprising on any sort of argument account. We would expect verbs occasionally that do require about. We find that for clausal arguments. Okay. So argument one. Argument two has to do with, and the rest of the arguments really have to do with the distribution of about phrases again. So I want to look at just how productive about is. So first, about does combine with a huge range of verbs. And I've given some examples in 28 here. So we have lots of mental state ones, dream, figure out, et cetera. Lots of communication ones. We have this interesting class that I've for now just called other, which, I mean, some of these do involve communication, but it's a little more complicated to try to classify them in any particular way. So how widespread is this? So in my data set, we find 170 verbs, like the one shown on this slide, that take just an about phrase. Okay, so this is 35% of the verbs. This is pretty comparable to the distribution, actually, of infinitival clause arguments in this data set. Skip that. You may be wondering, what about the other 384? I will return to them shortly, and we'll be able to massively balloon this number. So looking at this, at first glance, about phrases are just as productive as at least some kinds of clausal arguments. Just as a side note, they're massively productive when combining with nouns. Any noun that has anything remotely to do with content can take them. I'm going to be talking about that so much today. They can serve as predicates. I already mentioned that. But so the bullet point for this set of slides is that about phrases occur a lot with a lot of verbs. So let's drill into this a bit. So some of the accounts, some of the hypotheses that I sketched make predictions about exactly where about should occur. And this is what I want to test next. In particular, the account that says that you coerce about phrases into propositions, for example, says that we should be able to find correlations between the distribution of about phrases and that clauses, and similarly for other versions of this. So I'm going to focus for the moment on these 170 verbs. And so the summary of this table is that we find any possible combination. Not all of them are actually directly represented in this table. But there's no particular kind of clause type that you can reduce about to when you look at the selection restrictions. And perhaps the most interesting class for this argument is class 4, which I wouldn't have even had in my data set if I weren't looking specifically for about, because they don't take clauses at all. So there's actually a little bit of speaker variation on lie, but for talk. So talk is a very interesting verb. So you can talk about whether to go to the party. You cannot talk that you are going to the party. You can tell someone that you're going to the party. You can say that you're going to the party, but not talk that. And so talk, say, and tell form this triple, which all describe nearly the same kind of event, but have an apparently different argument structure. And at least talk and tell both take about. So we're going to have to do something different with about phrases. So this is a strike against a bunch of the accounts that I sketched at the beginning, especially the reductionist account. It's, of course, perfectly consistent with about phrases being modifiers. And just to give you some more examples that instantiate the endpoints of the scale. If you think you can reduce about phrases to propositions, you run into verbs like inquire, which take weather clauses but not that clauses. If you think you can reduce about phrases to question meanings, you run into verbs like argue that take that clauses but not interrogative clauses. So if you want to do this general reductionist account, you're just in a bind between these two ends of the scale. So we need a very general account to handle this data. Okay, so something you might have wondered about, what about pairs like 39? So Alfonso thought about Joanna's fine. Alfonso believed about Joanna's terrible. Right? And similarly, it constructed pairs with talk and discuss, ask and question. What to do with these pairs? So first observation, you do seem to be able to get about with these verbs in combination with a full clause. So it's not that about is out. So you can believe about Joanna that she was clever, et cetera. So these, as far as I know, don't tend to occur in real data, but these do. So questions where the WH item is abstracting over a gap in the content argument slot for believe. What did Alfonso believe about Joanna, et cetera? So about phrases can actually co-occur with clauses. So this is actually pushing us. This could be why FrameNet did what they did, in fact. But we want to know what's going on with these verbs. So there's a generalization, which is that it seems to be that this pattern is dependent on whether the verb has an intransitive frame in a similar sense. So think can be used intransitively, at least with the modifier. Believe has another sense. It's this sort of faith reading. But this isn't the sense that we're interested in, and for whatever reason, it doesn't take about. Because I'm working with this data set, I coded for whether verbs take intransitive frames. I used a pretty conservative, in one respect, definition of what this meant. So there's a little bit of variation in what the intransitive frame involves. But you can see the chi-square table here. It's just an incredibly clean generalization by sort of corpus work standards. Again, one always wonders what's going on in these two boxes. But the correlation between allowing just an about phrase and having an intransitive use versus allowing the about phrase only with the clause and having no intransitive use is excellent. Right? So it actually seems that this apparent puzzle, which you might have imagined was about the argument structure of think and believe, is really about an independent issue of what frames or syntactic selectional properties they have. So this is kind of a step beyond the optionality fact. This is extremely hard to explain if you think that about phrases are arguments. It's expected on any sort of modifier account. So now we can add to this initial 170 another 228 that take it only in combination with the clause, and then there's some remaining verbs slash, this is counted by frames, but some remaining verbs that don't take about. I'm not going to talk about those, but they're, of course, interesting. About is extremely productive in verbal context and shows up optionally in whatever available frames there are. So here's where we are. About phrases are always optional. They're productive, they're cross-categorical, they show up with a huge range of verbs. I skipped fact 2b in this presentation. The distribution of about phrases can't be derived from other selectional restrictions that exist. It seems to be its own thing. And co-occurrence with a clausal argument is nearly entirely predicted by whether the predicate itself allows or requires a clausal argument. So what this makes it look like is we're taking existing frames and slotting in about phrases into those frames. Okay, so about PPs or modifiers. Hopefully you're convinced now. This is sort of. If this were a linguistics, like a talk to people doing formal semantics, this would be structured quite differently. The first part would have been a little shorter, and I would now dive into the the formal part. I decided not to do that today. So what I'm going to try to do is just sketch what the consequences are for the theory of attitude verbs, a little bit about what the actual formal semantic analysis of about phrases is like, and then wrap up shortly. So what can we conclude from these, from this, from the facts on the previous slide? From the fact that about phrases are so productive, we do need a compositional, non-idiosyncratic analysis. We need to give some meaning to about. That, I think, is hopefully clear to everyone by now. I didn't talk about their internal regularity, but we do need a uniform account of about phrases for nouns and verbs. And then, most importantly, we need a modifier account. I've said that many times now, and we need a very general account that applies to many, many attitude verbs, nearly all of them, in fact, in my sample. By the way, some combination of UMD and Rutgers and Santa Cruz has a slightly differently annotated thing like this. So they have about 700 or 800 verbs, and they tend to think that they basically have them all. So that's a rough count for how many attitude verbs there are in English. So back to this textbook analysis. We have this verb think with these two thematic roles. On the textbook view, thinking relates this holder and this content proposition. So the question is, how can a modifier slot into this in a productive way? I should have capitalized this. We've seen that it can't be slotted into this role, right? It's maybe slightly more plausible to slot it into an extra role that's not represented here. So this is the FrameNet topic content thing, but then that doesn't capture the inference patterns, right? So this doesn't capture the truth conditional differences. The other approach doesn't capture the inference patterns. So what can we do? So there's this move in semantics and philosophy of language that began in the late 60s and to some extent has migrated through semantics maybe into computational semantics. I think this is a great thing. And this view is that verbs aren't relational at all, really. They serve to characterize events or states or situations or eventualities or whatever you want to call them. So events are things that happen. We at least perceive the world as being structured partly into events. They're sequenced in time. They have, sometimes have internal structure. They have participants, people who do things to other objects as part of the event, et cetera. And this is, of course, a lot of what our binary SRL project is about understanding. So the relational content in this view is recast in terms of who or what participates in an event and how. Right? So there's still thematic roles. There's still something like a content role. The content role exists at the syntax semantics interface, but there are other ways to get at the properties of an event besides this kind of role. And this, as Davidson argued, and many people followed one on, provides a great account of modifiers, right? So the modifiers modify the event. They just stack information about the event on top of what we already have. It's very simple. It's very monotonic. It's very clean. This move has been made in linguistics for attitude verbs recently by Valentin Hacard and others, including me. And the idea is that so this is very intuitive for verbs. Like, say, if you have a speech event, John said that it rained. Eventualities like saying events have this kind of dual life. So on the one hand, you have the thing that happens in the world. You have the communication event with someone and potentially an audience. On the other hand, you have some content, and it's intuitively for a saying event. This content is what was said during the event. Okay. So content arguments, clauses, at least as far as we've seen, directly characterize this content. And that's sort of the connection between lowercase content and uppercase content. About modifiers, indirectly characterize this content. So again, all these things just provide more information about the event on top of the verb, and about phrases do this indirectly, content arguments do it directly. And if you think about the content nouns that I've been flashing up occasionally, you'll see we need to generalize this beyond eventualities. You can have a book about computational linguistics, and this seems to intuitively be the same thing. Okay. So, the conclusion is that about phrases are distinct from content arguments. That about doesn't signal any particular semantic role per se. It's much too general for that, but rather signals modification of an event, and the event has to have content, and the about phrase tells you about that content. So instead of thinking of the role of this relational analysis, now the role of a clause embedding verb is to characterize an event with content. In fact, about phrases, I think, are the best argument for the generality of this approach. None of the other data that people have looked at is quite so general, but about phrases in English clearly delineate this class of verbs that have, that involve content. Okay, so we have multiple ways to get to fine-grained specification of event properties. A content argument can characterize the content, an about phrase can do that in a different way. So now what you should be wanting, and I won't really give you, is a theory of aboutness. Okay, so I have one. You can look it up. You can ask me about it. This is a notoriously hard problem, as you might have guessed in the history of philosophy. So there's this long history of very complicated attempts to it. It's been recently picked up by Stephen Yablo, and I've heard a few other prominent philosophers are working on this again. My particular theory is derived from the work of David Lewis in the 80s. He gave a sort of beginnings of a theory of aboutness. I've adapted in a possible world semantics. I've adapted it to this domain and tried. And I think I have a way of getting it to work in this very general way that's needed. But you'll have to take that as a promise for now. But just to give you an example, and then I'll conclude. So think back to talk. Talk is one of these mysterious verbs that don't take that clauses, and but do take about phrases. So we get this contrast between 52 and 53. So the analysis of these is very simple on this proposal, and I think it has to be the right analysis. So talking events are communication events that have content. It just so happens that at the syntax semantics interface, they don't project a content role or a content argument or whatever. So there's something like an intransitive version of tell. Because about phrases can apply to any event that you find that has content, they productively combine with talk. But there's no prediction that events with lowercase content must have a content argument, and this is exactly what we want. So this is what the event theory buys us at the end. I can tell you how it works with tell, but I'm just going to wrap up. Okay, so I always like to end with a fun prediction. So here's my last prediction from this theory. Flipping things on its head, we should expect that about is good if an event can be coerced into bearing content. So some events might not intrinsically have content, the verb might not really force this, but then an about phrase should force this. And this is exactly what we find. So these are the coming back to some of the other verbs. So you get these things like Alfonso hesitated about how to answer. So hesitate itself doesn't describe an event that has to have content. It could, but it need not. But when you combine it with this about phrase, it tells you something about Alfonso's mental state while he was in the act of hesitating, etc. And similarly for laugh. Okay. You find some really neat examples of these in the nominal domain. So you get things like the last hour was about. So hours, of course, don't need to have content, but because they're durations that we can sort of exist in and talk in, they turns out they can. With emotion predicates, their base meaning doesn't force content, but then when you combine it with an about phrase, you can get it. If you look at descriptions of program music, you find these. So program music is music that's supposed to have meaning in some sense. You find the word about used. So this is a constructed example, but these do occur, etc. So just to say this one more time, about phrases are modifiers, not arguments. They act as Neo-Davidsonian modifiers of events with content. In fact, it seems that they can serve as a diagnostic for content, and in some cases force the intuition that there is content to spring into existence. Their distribution is independent of capital C content arguments. And as a consequence, attitude predicates must involve a uniform and very general notion of content. That's the piece that I haven't really given you today. And that should be fine-grained. So I think this, I don't think any of you disbelieve this, so this is maybe preaching to the choir, but we do need some more fine-grained event semantics in addition to coarse-grained roles. So in the big picture, so this project would have been impossible without the, at least what by linguistic standards is pretty large-scale data work. And so I did this all by hand myself. There's better ways to do this. This is exactly the kind of project where I think computational resources and linguistic questions can meet. This is kind of what's happening in the binary SRL project. This is what's happening in the Maryland Rutgers Santa Cruz group. And so this is sort of an emerging area of contact for those of you interested in the science side of these questions that I think there's lots of ways that large-scale data work can help what the questions that we're asking. On the linguistic side, of course, this requires an event-based way of viewing semantics. This remains controversial despite the completely compelling arguments for it. And we need to extend this to a case where the standard view remains in most presentations rigidly relational. We need to have a uniform and general category of events and entities, it turns out, that have content. Okay. And finally, this is also preaching to the choir, so people who do annotation don't have problems with this point, but the linguistic literature has tended to been focused on just that clauses. Of course, just as when you're annotating data, when you're trying to understand what attitude verbs really do, the distributional facts mean that you can't do this. You have to look at more data than this. So, thank you. Darcy. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good question. I do have a slide. I don't need to put up the slide. So there's at least three senses of about in English. So one is the approximately sense. One is a spatial sense. So John walked about the room. And then one is this thing that I'm interested in. You can ask this question about the spatial sense too. So my guess, I haven't checked this, is that there's probably some historical relation. So some development path of these meanings that maybe led to a split, but this is just speculation. I had a student, Aaron Zurikian, who graduated a couple years ago, whose dissertation was one of the main, so she worked on approximation and she had an account of about, and I can tell you that just formally it doesn't look the same, right? So it's not obvious how to give a unified analysis, but I think there is the intuition that this sense of about involves taking some focused content and broadening what that could be, right? So being vague about what content you're actually talking about. And that there is some commonality, I think, between what's happening with about. Yeah. 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 And so one thing that Aaron looked at, so about actually doesn't do this. I don't know why, but some of the approximators actually can combine with more general predicates. So she looked at the meaning of phrases like approximately a chocolate cake. And so it doesn't, so approximation doesn't have to happen on one of these one-dimensional numeric scales. It can happen in more dimensions than just one, and that could be a way to generalize what's happening here to numeric about. Yeah, that's right, right. Yeah, except that it might go the other way. So capital C content is exact content. And then about, because there are different kinds of things too, I think, just in their syntactic behavior. So in terms of what they mean, that's right, I think. Anything else? Yeah, true.
Maybe how it differs for verbs versus nouns, because it seems like the coercion required to give a laughing event isn't much more stringent than the coercion I would have to do to say that projector screen is about.
Yeah, okay.
But that seems.
Right. Yeah, so. I think the basic answer is no. There's a sort of intuitive story I can tell you, which is that in all cases that I've looked at, coercion results in one of three readings. So you get coercion to communication event, that's the hour about semantics. You get coercion to a mental state, so these are hesitate about about whether to go to the party. And my speculation, and I'll say why this is just speculation at the moment, is that on this Neo-Davidsonian view, when you gain more meaning from different constituents in the sentence, you're doing this, you're just sort of monotonically adding to what you know about the event. And so hesitate, I think, is necessary. So one thing you learn from the verb in hesitate is that it's necessarily silent. It's maybe not obvious why that would be a property of the verb, but it does seem to be. It's maybe a little more complicated than that. And so from that plus the fact that that there is an about phrase, you have to infer that there's content and you can't go down the communication route. So laugh is something similar. So laugh is a voice event. It involves many of the same components as a communication event. But it necessarily, laughing itself necessarily has no content. It's just this repetitive pattern that we do. And so again, you have to coerce that into, so just the interaction of multiple monotonically added constraints leads to mental state being the only option. Why the hour gets coerced? Well, first I would have to check. I haven't checked if temporal predicates can be coerced into mental state content. So the story isn't really complete. The other reason the story isn't complete is that to really answer this question, you do need a complete and working theory of aboutness. I have a partial theory of aboutness, but this is, as I mentioned, a very hard problem. So there are these corner cases. I actually accept this slide is about my collaborators. I don't know if all of you agree, but if I were to write these names on the whiteboard, this becomes harder. And people's intuitions is something about the whiteboard being this transitory thing. To have something that's about it has to be a little more permanent. So there are these bounds on the outside edges of what aboutness can involve that I don't yet have a good handle on. The other thing to say is that all of this interacts with some incredibly fascinating data. I just copied tons of slides into the end here, so I might have to, yeah. So if you have a sentence like the book is about Rasputin, there's this intuition, which I expect you'll have, that it isn't sufficient that Rasputin be briefly discussed in one paragraph somewhere in the book. So the content of a book is large and rich, and just having some content somewhere that has to do with Rasputin isn't enough. But it turns out when you look at some more data that about phrases are gradable. Okay, they can be modified themselves by part-whole adverbs and various others. So part of the theory of aboutness, and this is where some of the recent work by Yablo has focused, is we need a rich theory of the part structure of contents in order to fully capture all this meaning. So you get examples like this. The book is obliquely about Rasputin, tangentially, sort of, partly, completely, entirely, all about Rasputin, which change how much the content is related to the thing provided by the internal argument of about. And so people actually do accept this whiteboard is all about my collaborators now. And so it's sort of a puzzle why they do that. But this data, I think, is where the action and the challenge is in coming up with a real theory of aboutness. So it's ongoing work is the answer.
I think about under-specifying the content. You've been looking at a sentence at a time, but if I looked at it in context, paragraph above, below, or like whatever context, is it true that the reader and the writer share some context, and that's why it's okay to use it?
Usually. Especially with about DP arguments to verbs. There's some pretty high salience requirement in many cases to actually get to the meaning. So that's something I have a worked out theory of in the formalism, and I've sort of glossed over that, but that is important. So one way of thinking about this is that if about is like the vague version of capital C content, in general, to resolve vagueness, you need, if it's important to resolve vagueness, you need more context. In many of the cases that we've discussed, it turns out to be important to resolve vagueness. It's not always true for vague predicates, but for about phrases, it seems to be true. And so what I would hope is that some of the same mechanisms that have been used in the vagueness literature would work here. But yeah, that's a good question. Thanks.